It's got moved.
I'm sorry, but that's, you can't deny that was a little bit. Watch him go, and just fucking fall apart. Sunrise, bring in the morning. Sunrise, bring in the morning. Spreading all the light all around. Sunrise, something about a kangaroo boy. Sunrise, something else about fucking corks with axles. Spreading all the light all around. Freedom lovers.
Season 4, episode. Nice. You have a hernia over there.
Season 4, episode 5. Or 6.
That's awesome. I thought your eye was going to come out.
Are we still recording?
Yes.
Season 4, episode
6.
Season 4, episode 6.
I'm Nate Bradshaw.
Welcome to that. I am
Laughing Boy Bacon over there.
John O'Bacon.
Laughing Boy Bacon.
Matthew Ramel.
And I'm Stuart Langridge.
Welcome
to the show. So, season whatever it is, four. Episode, I don't really care.
Six.
That's the one. Five.
No, six.
Yep. Oh, shut your face.
Okay. So what are we going to pretend that we talked about in the show?
Planets.
Pushing
the death of.
Death, yes. Of planets. Do planets make any sense whatsoever?
Are we just like yet another step behind the exchange world now that push email is a big thing? Are.
Yep, we're going to talk to someone from Rapath.
Someone from Rapath.
Fucking Rapath.
You said path rather than path.
I did, because it makes it sound funny.
Right, okay.
Rapath. With their Rebuild application.
And yep. Sean Connery. What else?
Interesting stuff.
Yeah. Anything else that we're going to talk about?
Oh, not really.
No, should we get on with it?
Yep.
Should we rock on?
Let's get the show on the road.
We're back.
Rapath.
At the moment, as we record, there are some chaps from Greenpeace up a tower at Didcot Power Station in Oxfordshire. Mm. And they're shouting, save the planet. I say, don't save the planet.
Don't save planets.
Don't save the planet. Don't save the planets. And I'm not talking about bloody Earth.
The environment.
Or Jupiter or anything like that. I'm talking about planet software.
Everybody's favourite aggregator.
Yeah. Now,
yawn.
A few weeks ago, one of the co-authors of Planet was sitting just there to my right.
He was.
Scott James Remnant.
Yeah. He's now been replaced by a guitar case.
Yeah. So I'm not actually having
neither here nor
everyone
there.
Could feel a crack there. Decided not to say anything.
So anyway,
everyone's brains were ticking over.
Right, go on.
So anyway, I'm not saying anything against Planet the aggregator, but it does annoy
what?
Me.
What are you saying? It's really annoying. Say something against it.
You said it was shite earlier on.
No, I didn't. not the software.
You said that Sam Ruby. He's a twat. I don't know why he's bothered to fork.
That who?
Sam Ruby thought he'd make Planet Venus, which is a better version of Planet.
Oh, right, okay. All right, never heard of him. So anyway,
neither have I.
My problem with planet sites is that people tend to think that you give a damn about their cat.
Mundane little lives.
Yeah, their views on politics, their zombie parties. Sorry, Jeff.
There's some very specific examples coming through.
And their new machine that they're building or whatever, when really what you're doing is you're signing up to, I don't know, Planet Ubuntu and you want to find out Ubuntu. Planet Gnome, you want to find out about Gnome. And you don't...
So you don't want to know anything about the background of the people. You just want to know...
If I did, then I'd go and subscribe to their own blog. And basically,
your idea is more that you should have kind of an Ubuntu category on your website.
Absolutely.
Just like, have you done that?
Yes, that is exactly what I've done. So that when I post something about Voice of Russia World Service, which interests me and I want to put on my blog, I don't expect every... flipping person who reads the Planet Ubuntu site to give a damn about my stupid listening habits on the radio.
I disagree.
If I say something about Ubuntu, then I think it's relevant.
You see, I think we should set up Asteroid Ubuntu, which has only got the good people.
Planetesimal.
Planetoid.
Yes. Some kind of elitist group.
Yeah, all the people are interesting.
I can see your point here, but I think one of the things I quite like about the planet...
Or a tiny dead rock.
One of the things I quite like about the planet... Like, Planet Gnome is probably the best example of the planet because it's immensely popular. Probably the biggest planet, I'd imagine.
It was certainly
as the guys who founded it wrote Planet.
Yes.
And I think one of the nice things is that you get to know a bit more about the people. If I wanted to know about what people are doing, I'd read fucking CVS commit logs.
One
of the nice things is that you get to know, like, for example, although Louis Villa, I have a lot of respect for him, and he posts a lot of legal shite on there, some of which I'm not interested in, some of the stuff that he posts, as an example, is quite interesting.
I'll tell you the solution. The solution
What's
is...
What's the solution, Aid?
The solution is a series of tick boxes, right? So, certain people, they're always boring, right? And they always write too much about boring shit, right? So you need to be able to go up and just untick them, from the planet, and then we'd be able to read the rest of the planet.
Well, you like see, Planet Karma sort of stuff.
This is the interesting point. I mean,
it's always the same people who are boring, isn't it?
It is. And what was that bloke's name off of Planet Gnome?
And they produce a disproportionate amount.
Yeah. No, I mean,
Mime-tastic.
The thing that's interesting, the reason I think planets are a bit of a problem
is
that they're really boring. You get quite a lot of people who they'll write something about what they're doing, and then they'll write something about how they went on holiday or whatever. And people will say, why do you have to write stuff about when you're on holiday? And then the people who write the blog, their argument is, if you don't like it, don't fucking read my website, which is perfectly reasonable.
Yeah.
The problem with if you subscribe to a planet is you don't get a choice about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have you have to get all of it. But to my mind, that's not a job for Planet Gnome. That's a job for your RSS aggregator. Your RSS aggregator should learn the stuff you like to read.
No, it's not. It's a job for the people to have the decency to limit what they put on the planet.
Well, no,
to be about what the planet's about.
But the point there is, Jono, for instance, likes to read.
Then let him subscribe to their individual blogs.
But then
because that's the option that he's got.
But then he doesn't get. Then he doesn't get the benefit of having the stuff about Ubuntu aggregated for him. The whole point.
But it's stuff about Ubuntu being aggregated. It's stuff by a bunch of people who happen to be into Ubuntu being aggregated about anything. Whereas the idea to me that would make planets better would be if you were to get stuff about the theme.
Solution is
a second solution. This is
the final solution.
Final solution.
Wait for it. Are you ready?
Nice term.
Here it comes. Planet 2.0. Wait for it.
Beta.
And what you do is when you subscribe your feed, right? You've got granular control, so you know you have categories on your blog, right?
As well.
You can say, I only want to subscribe the Linux one and not the health one and not the home matters.
But that's what Matt's done. That's exactly what Matt was saying.
No, but you as a person, not the person
as
who's submitting, you as a reader can tick those boxes.
I mean, the solution
I don't care about somebody's cat.
The solution's fairly simple.
You can't do that without a worldwide
Planet 2.0. That's the solution.
You can't do that without a worldwide taxonomy.
It's fine.
But there isn't one. That's how easy it is. There it is, worldwide taxonomy. Right? It won't work. Shut up. Whoopah.
I hope the microphone picked that slap up.
Oh, it's the solution, though, I'm telling you.
It's not the solution.
It is.
Because if you and I, say we do a planet, there's Planet Lug Radio in
there. Yeah.
Right? And
you don't want to read about my car, right? And I don't want to read about anything that you do, to be honest.
But if someone doesn't want to read about either your car or my car, it relies on us both calling car things the same name.
But that's fine.
But we're not gonna.
The car section would be called car.
Mine wouldn't be called cars, it'd be called Mercedes.
Hang on. There's no reason...
You're a twat.
I've got a Mercedes. I haven't got a car.
Surely the best thing... Surely where we are today is that people can have RSS feeds based on different categories in their blogs.
Yeah.
And then you just subscribe the relevant category to the relevant planet.
If only you could.
That was... No, that would... Well,
that's my idea. You can't.
You can. People do that.
I've done that.
You have to have a different feed for each category.
Yeah, which you have.
Yeah.
WordPress does that already.
And then you can have another feed for all of everything.
Oh. Yeah, that was Matt's argument. But
Somebody beat me to the
problem with that is that you, Jono, like to read all the stuff that is specifically about No More Ubuntu.
The thing is, I mean, it's interesting. I remember, like, when I was involved with the KD project, the way you read about what people were doing is you read mailing lists. So people read KD Devel, and everything was very, very specific on topic generally until the list went a bit shit. But it was generally. Pretty specific. People didn't talk about how they got up that morning and
it was generally specific.
Specifically
general.
They didn't talk about how they got up that morning and baked a cake
and a bit of morning wood.
Some by the Beatles.
Cleared the pipes before they went to work and all the rest of it. But the thing is that I think one of the nice things about planets is you do get to know people a little bit more. And yes, some people will babble all the time about crap. And I'd say that, like, maybe if 3 in 5 posts or 4 in 5 posts are approximately on the subject or closely related subjects, that's fine. The problem is you need to
be able to K-line people.
The problem is when you get specific people who are completely off topic.
Yeah.
Now, there's one example that
it's always Matt the same person
insinuated on Planet Gnome that is no longer on Planet Gnome, right?
Isn't he? Oh, good. I think like so.
And you get this from time to time on planets where some people are just completely off topic.
But here's the thing, though,
it's a job for your aggregator.
But the thing is,
you should be able to say in your aggregator, subscribe to the Planet Gnome feed, but I don't care about this bloke. Basically, you want to be able to kill people. You know, I mean,
unless that person does come out with something interesting.
Stop the planet. I mean, the thing is,
with your blog, right? Yours is fine. Because
Matt points to Jono.
Sorry, Jono Bacon, right? It's very rare that you write something that's not related to free software. Occasionally,
beard.
You say, no, hang on. Okay,
this is my dog. Have a look.
Here's my dog. Here's Christopher Lee talking about metal on the breakfast program.
Occasionally, you will veer a little away, but you won't go into boring fuck-ass detail.
Who cares about his dog?
I do.
No, but it doesn't go into detail.
The worst thing about... He fucking does go into detail. He's 82 pictures about my dog.
No, that was three posts
in succession about my dog.
No, the difference is I put in...
And the worst thing about your thing is when you post a thing about your dog, I have to read it 3 fucking times because it's on Planet Gnome and Planet Ubuntu and on your blog itself.
The thing is, I put my own bits and pieces that aren't related to free software. But one of the nice things about planets as well is that, for example, take Jocosha as an example. Part of the reason why a lot of people are interested in Jocosha right now is
Jocosha?
Yeah, you may have heard of it.
We need a planet Jocosha.
Yeah, we do. But I've got an idea for a project. Let's set up a planet. And a wiki. The thing is that I'm on 3 planets,
Drugs?
3 or 4 planets. I post about Jocosha. Planet Gnome people are probably going to know about Jocosha anyway because it's a known program. The advocacy people who read on Planet Advocacy, they might not know about it, so they're now aware of it.
But
so,
that's fine because that's interesting to those people.
But this is the thing, is that interesting is subjective.
No, it's not.
I mean, yes, in the grand scheme of things, it is. Hang on.
But it's always the same offender to you.
There is someone...
Although it's subjective to you, it's always the same.
For example, recently on one planet, I can't remember which one, there was a bloke who posted a thing saying, oh, I want to do this with my new PC, I might buy these components, listed a load of crap. And they said, oh, I wonder if I'll do it. A couple of weeks later, oh, I've bought the bits now I'll have to put them together. Here are the components I've bought. Right? Then about a couple of days later, I'll put them together now. I don't care!
But that is boring! But say, like, Ron, for instance, might actually find that quite interesting, whereas he couldn't give a toss about Jocosha.
Then he needs to subscribe to Planet Hardware.
When the bloke subscribes his website to Planet Hardware... Right? Then everyone on Planet Hardware is going to say, but I don't care about this GNOME program you're writing. This is Tech Planet boxes. Hardware, don't you know? Shut up about software.
Let's go back to my original point that you give a feed for the relevant categories.
Exactly, but then you don't get to learn anything about the background of the people. All you get to read about
is subscribe to their blogs. Exactly, if you want to find out about... To me, planets are a great way of getting a quick snapshot of what's going on in a particular community, right?
Or alternatively, just skip over the posts that you're not interested in. Just ignore them.
But when you get
a signal-to-noise ratio where there's loads more noise than signal,
when there's more noise than signal, which I'd say isn't the case with most planets. Some planets are generally on topic, right? then the planet needs changing. They need to get different people. They need to take some people off. Because, of course, people start out interested and then their blogs turn into other things.
But with some planets, you can't take them off because it's a... Oh, if you've got the technical wherewithal,
yeah, but that's not
do it yourself.
That's not a problem with the planet concept. That's a problem with the way that specific planet's
run.
The thing is that I think if you want to know specific things about specific projects, read mailing lists. That's the best place to do that. You get none of the chatter. Mm. Part of the nice thing about planets is you get to know the developers, the people who are behind the software in our community.
I think it's a middle way though, is that you can get developers or whoever's individual spin on something. Related to the project, which is better than just the dry mailing list, but you don't have to find out about their cat.
Okay, tonight we're speaking to Matt Wilson from Rapatha Linux. They're based in Raleigh, just like their friends at Red Hat. And they're well, Matt, I tell you what, you tell us all about Rapatha. What you guys do and about Connery and our builder.
Sure. First, let me give you a little history about our path. We started doing development in February of 2004. We were founded on the engineering side by Eric Troen, who is the first engineer at Red Hat, a longtime open source free software developer and contributor. Michael K. Johnson, who managed the kernel engineering team at Red Hat. And myself, I was responsible for the operating system side of things, so pretty much anything that had to do with system installation, hardware detection, printing,
right.
Anything that wasn't compilers and kernels kind of fell onto my team.
Right.
So around that time, Eric gave me a call. I was still at Red Hat, and he was saying that he had some ideas on how to revolutionize how we manage software, and Eric being the original author of RPM, we had several things we wanted to change in the way that RPM managed software on the system, but we weren't really able to do it due to the kind of the legacy code base and right. the how many people use RPM. You couldn't go and completely change the model of the
yeah,
thing
of course, yeah.
without breaking it. And that really intrigued me, because over and over we ran into RPM's limitations at Red Hat, and we couldn't really figure out a good way to kind of wipe the slate clean, and if we had to do it all over again, what design decisions would we make differently?
Okay.
Now, so that's Connery, yeah?
That's Connery, is it?
That's right. So Connery is our new world, the slate wiped clean, and really taking a different approach to managing software on a system, building software, managing it, and providing updates, and especially enabling distributed development of software and bringing it all together into a working system.
So there was nothing else out there at the time, I've got a couple of Debian people sitting next to me, and they keep mouthing the word Deb at me. So,
right,
I mean,
sure. Go ahead.
But was that not applicable or not usable or...?
Well, both RPM and dpackage they have very similar kind of histories as far as they were kind of developed around the same time. Dpackage being a little bit earlier on the scene than RPM, but right. But both are still very very package file oriented. You end up with repositories, be it yum repositories or app repositories, that have packages in them, but it doesn't really enable distributed development in the way that Canary does, in order to control either dpackage build rules or RPM spec files, you're usually putting it into another repository system, another version control system like Subversion or CVS or something like that. Hmm. And it doesn't enable the distributed development that Canary was designed to do.
Okay, you're gonna have to help me out a bit here.
Sure.
You said Rapatha or whatever enables distributed development a few times
right.
in a way that Debs or whatever don't. But how? I mean, can you give us the
sure.
30-second thumbnail sketch of how that actually works from a sort of
Absolutely.
You know technical end?
Sure. So what RPath does is we developed Canary. We also package a Linux distribution called RPass Linux using Canary. That distribution is supposed to be very kind of vanilla, following the upstream open source and free software communities. And we provide that as a base for people who want to build their own systems. So we have another community project out there that is run by a group of people who want to integrate the very latest GNOME desktop and other kind of desktop innovations that are going on. Huh. And they take RPath Linux and take probably 80 to 90% stock RPath Linux, and then they mix in their own Canary repository just those parts they care about, the bleeding edge GNOME releases and CompViz and Barrel and all those kinds of things.
Okay.
And they come out with a really nice, shiny desktop. But they don't have to worry about the operating system at all. They just inherit it. And they only have to worry about maintaining those parts of the operating system that they do care about.
Okay. I mean, I feel I'm being a bit stupid here, but you said Debs or RPMs, you don't have to, you've got this kind of centralized repository and it doesn't enable distributed development, but you just said that the people have their own Canary repositories.
That's right.
So if you've got repositories for both of them, I'm not seeing what's cool about Canary that isn't cool about everything else. I'm obviously missing something.
Oh, well, I'm probably not doing a good job explaining it, but what Canary lets you do, for example, it lets you make these distributed branches between repositories that that kind of define how things are related to one another. So, for example, if the RPath Linux developers wanted to take the GDM package that we have and kind of change the default theme, all they have to do is make a distributed branch in their repository and add a patch. That way, when we make another change down the line, like if GDM has a security bug fix and we integrate that, in order to take that bug fix and their change and merge it all together, they only have to type a couple of commands in Canary. Go ahead.
All I was going to say was you're saying the RPMD package kind of model is like Subversion or CVS, whereas what you're doing is more akin to a distributed source control
system.
Bizarre, whatever.
That's not a direct thing, but more of a kind of an analogy, the difference between the two.
And sometimes we do explain it that way, how before Linus took the kernel sources and adopted BitKeeper, he had his centralized tree.
Yeah.
And when he started using BitKeeper, people were able to clone his tree and make their changes, and he was able to pull changes from them and so on. The same hasn't happened yet until Canary came to the scene as far as pulling together software to define a whole system.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like pretty cool technology. The thing that I'm interested to know is, I believe that you folks at Repath want to make money from this, is that right?
That's true.
So, people in the past have tried making money from software distribution and rolling out software in different ways, and a lot of them have failed. So, how is this going to be any different?
Right. So, other people have tried to provide update services and that were taking software and either providing a way to install it onto a distribution or to provide update packages from operating system vendors.
Yeah.
And what we're doing is a much different approach. Now, before I was talking about Canary, and that was kind of the open source side of the thing. This is RPath and RPath's business. What we're doing as a company is we're going to software vendors, software ISVs, and saying instead of porting your software to Red Hat Linux and SLES from SUSE, Novell, and also to Solaris and Windows, if you were able to bundle an operating system with your application and make it easy to install, in other words, just dropping a CD into a machine and having it install in the bare metal, or giving their customers a ready-to-run VMware image or Xen image, where they just start up the virtual machine and their software is ready to run, that's an easier way for their customer to consume the software.
But isn't it a case that
right now, one of the benefits that we've got, whether using, let's say, Fedora or Ubuntu or whatever, is that the software distribution process is fairly integrated. I mean, one of the downsides to some systems, for example, Auto Package, and people have tried doing similar sort of things in the past, is that you can install them, but it doesn't really integrate in with your system. Isn't that going to be a glaring problem in the Repath strategy?
Well, I think that virtualization really addresses it, in that we believe in the future you'll be acquiring software from one software vendor, and they're going to give you a virtual appliance that you plug into either Xen or VMware.
Right. Okay.
And you bring up that that appliance, and then you'll acquire from another software vendor another piece of software, and you'll just plug that one in.
Yeah.
And
totally.
Any communication that needs to be done between the two is most likely going to be done through network protocols, XML, RPC, SOAP. Any other kind of communication between the components should be all done both basically at the network layer.
So Repath Linux is basically set up to make it easier for commercial proprietary software vendors to get set up in the Linux world. Is that right?
Well, not only proprietary software vendors, but open source software vendors as well. Okay. For example, are you familiar with the Gallery project from Pete?
Yeah.
So the Gallery guys have used Repath Linux and RBuilder, which we have a free version online called RBuilder Online, to take Gallery, both Gallery 1 and Gallery 2,
yeah.
And they've made an appliance out of it. So you can actually download from RBuilder Online a Gallery appliance that has sample albums, and all you have to do is bring it up in either VMware or I can't remember if they've made installable ISO images or not, but the most popular thing to do seems to be to run it in VMware or VMware Player. And you can play around with the galleries, remove their samples, and even add your own photos to it. So go ahead.
So RBuilder is basically a system to create these customized versions of Repath and to create an image. Then is that right?
Right. That's a lot of what RBuilder does. It gives you a way to create and manage Canary repositories. And then you go off and add your software to the Canary repository by doing builds. You write simple recipe files that are a lot easier to understand than RPM spec files or depackaged build rules or even portage e-build files. And you build your software into the repository.
Yeah.
And once it's there, you can define a group. And that group tells RBuilder exactly what goes into a particular software image.
Right.
And then you can make either, just by clicking in the RBuilder interface, an installable ISO image or a VMware player or a raw hard drive image that works with QEMU.
Yeah.
And we just announced this week that we've integrated Xen 303 into Repath Linux, and we can create Xen DOMU images directly out of RBuilder Online.
Cool. That's very good. Now, I first came across Repath when I found Xenos VMware player image.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's obviously what we've talked about so far have been software appliances.
Right.
Do you ever see yourself moving over into hardware appliances?
We have customers that do both.
Right. Okay.
Both software applications that they're expecting for their customers to either install on their own hardware or run in a VMware kind of VMware player kind of thing.
Okay.
We also have customers that are providing both the hardware and the software together to be a real hardware appliance. And
gotcha.
We just make it easier for them to get to market with their hardware appliance by simplifying the system image creation part.
Oh, cool. Interesting.
Cool. I mean, just very quickly, I assume the sort of people who you are imagining will take advantage of this are likely to be people deploying large pieces of kind of consultingware software rather than people deploying gedit.
Right.
You're not going to have the 15 applications I use every day, each one in an individual Repath image.
Right, right. It's more of the back office kind of server-oriented pieces of software. things like one of our customers is Digium, and the version of Asterisk Business Edition comes with an RPath Linux based OS that has Asterisk integrated.
Good stuff.
So that's one thing that fits very nicely into the model, where that machine is going to be back in the server room. Likewise, you know, if you're going to have something set up, I don't know, to do blogging or set up gallery, it's a lot easier just to pull down one of these appliance images and boot it up, and your software is ready to run. So
I'm sold.
No, okay. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Not a problem.
Yeah. And best of luck with the project, and hope it all goes well.
5 minute update.
Yes. Can we catch up with you later for a 5 minute update?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. So thank you very much, Matt Wilson from Repath Linux.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
The interview.
Yeah, nice one. Thanks, Matt Wilson from Repath.
Am I going to get a VM appliance to run gedit? You muppet.
He was making a point.
Well, yeah, I mean, the way the guy seemed to be talking was kind of, we just see you just deploying applications on Repath, right? And you think, well...
No, come on, we all know it's not Repath, don't we?
Repath.
He took it very well.
He did. He was very careful to say, RPath. I go, it's fucking RPath, you morons! It's not Repath!
And we had our comeback perfectly waiting for him, but...
Yeah, never.
Should we tell him what the comeback was?
No. A joke explained is a joke spoiled, I think. But
yes, Dad.
But yeah, I mean, the point I made that about was, are you going to run gedit and Firefox and, you know, Nautilus all in separate...
it's not really for desktop stuff.
It's not for that, is it? Repath.
Well, no, I mean, that was the point of the question. He didn't make clear that it's for these things where you get three guys in a suit to come in and sell you this consultingware thing for £100,000. Well,
The clue was where he said appliance.
Well, but he's talking about gallery.
Yeah, you get a gallery appliance.
That was just an example.
Gallery's pretty noddy by comparison with the sort of stuff.
Specifically asked him, is it just for, you know, proprietary software? So he just came up with an example of an open source project.
Okay.
So
a Windows guy could go and get a gallery VMware image and just click play. But you wouldn't necessarily know how to install.
I think for the idea of taking single shot applications, it's a really good idea.
The whole VMware application thing is a really good idea. Kudos to VMware for actually coming out with it.
It's pretty good. I mean, I don't really buy the idea of it fitting into most distros and that kind of side of things.
He didn't mention that, did he?
Didn't he say that the idea is that they were going to work with distros and people like that to make sure that this technology kind of works well?
No, I think
well
he was more talking about working with Zen and working with.
But yeah, I mean, I think it seems quite interesting. I don't know if they got a business model in it though. I mean, it sounds like you could theoretically make quite a lot of money from application vendors who want to provide something fairly easy, you know, to use. But I don't know whether there is money
in the VM appliance market. Obviously, VMware do.
Yeah.
Well, VMware, I think there is, but they're providing the infrastructure on which it runs. If I was
for free,
Oracle are a bad example because they've just come up with Unbreakable Linux. But someone like Oracle.
Damn them.
Think of a large scale software vendor. PeopleSoft.
That is Oracle.
Oh, yeah, isn't it? Yeah.
But SAP's a good example.
If I was the SAP people,
you sucked him in.
I can see me thinking, okay, why don't we just basically run the application on Linux, but don't tell anybody that we're running on Linux. You just basically make RPath be your abstraction layer to everything else.
Yeah.
You won't let the RPath people make it work, run on Zen and run on Windows and VMware and stuff like that. The problem is, I'm not sure where their business model is, because if the RPath people then said, and now you have to pay us for that, I'd go, okay, we'll build it on Ubuntu then.
Yeah.
You know, or we build it on Slackware or Gentoo or something.
But you can. You've got the skills to do that. I think probably their target audience...
Anyone that's capable of writing SAP or the sort of applications they're talking about deploying on, it should be that.
But have they, though? SAP don't have in-house Linux distribution guys, do they?
But you don't need Linux distribution. I'm not sure how it's easier to put SAP on RPath Linux than it is to put SAP on Gentoo Linux, for example. I mean, maybe he sort of waved his hands and our builder does all this for you, and you have Conery repositories and stuff.
Conery as in Sean Conery.
Conery head.
I don't know. I think I have reservations about the kind of the integration thing, because, you know, if it's sitting inside this appliance, how does it fit in with the rest of the system, the rest of your IT infrastructure and things like that? And with applications like SAP and things like that, in many ways, a lot of these things talk to each other in different ways, and they need to obviously nail that
problem. I mean, maybe that's going out.
That's called a network card, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily. Well, not necessarily. Actually, this is. You see, part of that, I think part of the problem here is that I don't really fully quite understand exactly how it works.
Right. You've played with VMware appliances, though, right?
No, I have done, right. But I don't really see how they're. The one thing I didn't quite get from him was how all of this kind of stuff fits together, if you see what I mean. How these appliances will fit into your organisation. I mean, is it just a case you basically have a stock machine and you dump it on there? And
yeah,
then it
was
just
talking about you could do it from bare metal if you wanted to, right. Or you could do it on, you know, so I mean, someone, you might have a large corporation and they want to have a MySQL. They might want to have they might want to have a Zimbra appliance and just a machine that does Zimbra. And, you know, I imagine that if they could just have a disk that sticks it on, does it. But
it's a pretty cool idea.
I mean, moving away...
There is the idea that if you just get the Zimbra disk and you say, okay, install it on the bare metal and it works. But a smaller organisation might think, well, we haven't got a spare machine just for this Zimbra thing, but we've got a machine which isn't doing very much at the moment, so we'll stick it in VMware and run it on there. Mm. So it gives you a choice of ways
to deploy it. We had a virtualised Zimbra server.
Yeah.
Moving slightly away from Repath itself and into the more general idea of specialized Linux distributions. I mean, obviously one thing that, I mean, if you just look down the distro watch list, you'll see loads and loads of different versions of Linux specialized at different what?
Sorry, no, I just wonder how you're going to bring up the word Ubuntu here.
I wasn't. Okay. You come down, you know, you've got Tiny Sofa and you've got all the different Linux distributions.
No one's seen Tiny
the
Sofa.
The example of a pointless distro.
And you've got KTOS and you've got Peanut and you've got Puppy and all these different ones.
Yeah, come on.
And then you have things like Monowall and, I know that's BSD, but you have all these different distributions that are specialised for a particular thing. And then, yes, Canonical are doing different ones. So you've got Zubuntu, Edubuntu. So do you think we're going to go even more increasingly down the path of slight variations on major distributions?
Yeah, definitely.
Because, I mean, one thing that I wonder is, why couldn't Repath do this in Red Hat?
Well, I think...
Red Hat.
I think he explained the difficulties that he came across with RPMs.
Well, that's RPMs.
Yeah.
That's not...
Oh, yeah,
DEBs.
But you couldn't say, I think in order to make this kind of derivative distribution stuff that we're talking about possible, you have to sack off RPMs. Yeah. You're never going to convince the rest of Red Hat to go along with that plan.
I think in terms of the derivative things, the one thing I've experienced recently, for example, is with the Canonical, with the Ubuntu Loco teams, a lot of people want their distro in their language. And... like the disks that come from, like, Shipit as an example, they come with English as the default language. Mm. So you're finding these groups of Ubuntu fans, or I'm sure the Fedora project have the same thing as well, who would basically take it and changing the language pack so it's their default language, and then making that as a different derivative.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very, very slightly...
Well, just by changing the language?
Just by changing the language.
Well, yeah, but there's Ubuntu Christian Edition, isn't there?
Yeah, there's,
which
yeah.
has, like, a couple of Bible things on it, and call it a different district.
Aid mocks the religion.
but the point is that all it is Ubuntu with a couple of extra debs installed by default. And what I'm saying is I wonder about the whole derivatives thing. I think there are definite situations in which it's a really good idea, but I wonder if it could be taken too far. You know,
I think it depends. I think it largely depends on the company who's behind the distro and their approach to it as well. Because I mean, like from what I can tell, most of the distros are fairly happy for this to happen.
Yeah,
and they encourage it in many ways. I mean, there's loads of derivative distributions of Red Hat. There's loads of derivative distributions of Debian, but I think it's quite good in certain situations. Like, for example, Mubuntu or Demuddy or, you know...
Dynabolic.
Dialabolic.
Yeah, Dialabolic.
You know, they're great because they take certain things and it's a bit more expansive and they fit them together. Mm. When you come to things like just changing the language, I see that as a little bit more pointless because you've got all this completely different branding, which I understand because Canonical, as an example, don't necessarily want to confuse different distros together, you know. So if somebody says, "Okay, I've got the Czech version of Ubuntu,"
Czech,
then they don't necessarily have screwed that kind of thing up, and Canonical don't necessarily want to be able to support that properly.
Yeah.
But what we need the solution to my view, shouldn't be a derivative distribution. You should just have that version of Ubuntu in lots of different languages.
That's coming then down to the whole Iceweasel Firefox thing, isn't it? It's about the people who own the name basically being happy to put their name on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think just very briefly, you, everyone in this room, and I imagine most of the people listening to this show, would be aware that if you just get stock Ubuntu and then you remove 5 or 6 packages and you add 5 or 6 different packages and change the desktop background, there's not that much difference in between the two.
Yeah.
And if you rebrand it as a totally different thing and then go, look, it's for vertical markets and all this, you think, well, that's not very much of a change. But if you look at cars, right, you've got the Smart 4x4 and the Mitsubishi Colt, and they're completely different cars, but they're not. They're exactly the same fucking car with a different body shell on. But they're marketed in different ways. They're marketed to different markets. They're done in completely different things.
Yep.
And people don't go, well, I'd buy that car or that car, and I don't know which to choose because they're the same car. But they've got a different vibe about
them. But R-Path isn't Red Hat. I mean, it's based on Red Hat, but I mean, surely it's like stripped out. And
I imagine R-Path is probably quite different to Red Hat.
R-Path is there to help people build further.
To build appliances, and it's aimed at that market.
The important thing to remember, of course, about derivatives is part of the reason why we have so many derivative distributions is because the companies that make the original distros don't want those distros having the same name because of trademark issues as well. Right. So basically,
so just use a first letter.
So using CentOS is the classic example.
Yeah.
All hail the CentOS.
It's not called Red Hat Enterprise Server 3 Edition.
Yeah. And I can perfectly understand Red Hat's perspective.
Well, yeah, of course, they don't want to put their name on something that they haven't.
So, yeah, but it would be nice. I think it would be nice if we had more distros under the same approximate brand. And I know Aid's going to spit, but in the same way that Canonical have got Kubuntu and Edubuntu and Ubuntu, they're all part of the same family, essentially. No, but it's true. I mean, it would be nice for Red Hat, for example, to say, okay, well, we're going to consider CentOS part of our family. And even though it's not got the brand in there, it's not exactly the same brand, then it's part of the same. So people, if they've got confidence in Red Hat, they can approximately have confidence in CentOS.
I mean, there's no difference in between Red Hat Enterprise Server. The point is, if you're Canonical, you can say you can use Kubuntu or Zubuntu or Ubuntu, and one of them works with GNOME, and one of them's with KDE, and one of them's
XFCE,
a spec for slightly lower spec computers, but it makes them more useful and stuff like that. Whereas if Red Hat said, okay, you've got Red Hat Enterprise Server and CentOS, and people said, what's the difference? And you go, that one costs money and that one doesn't. And that's the only difference.
No. CentOS is a bad example.
Everyone's going to go, well, fuck me, I wonder which I should choose.
CentOS is a bad example, but you know what I mean. It's a community derived distribution. If they started adding loads of shit in there, then it'd be nice for it to be this part of the same thing.
Fosos do push email using Exchange Service Pack 2, right?
Read.
So what this means is if you get a Windows Mobile 5 device, that will automatically send on your email from your Exchange account to your mobile device.
So this is built into Exchange and built into Windows Mobile.
Only Service Pack 2 and above.
Yeah, but that's...
This is the Exchange 2003 Service Pack 2, is it?
Right, yeah, so we don't have to worry about it. So, it is. Because most people will probably be running it.
Right.
But, okay. So we've got that, right? And it's a service that customers who subscribe to the Exchange service from Fastos get for free. And it's built into Windows Mobile Phones, built into Exchange. Where is that in the open source world? To me, it just seems like yet another thing where Exchange is stepping forward and we've got nothing. Now, I appreciate that Zimbra.
I would have said Zimbra because they're all about mobile devices, but we had a quick look on their website and they don't seem to mention push email. And I'm pretty sure if they did push email, they'd be blasting it all over the website.
And
so,
if you've got an Exchange server, then...
But it's the same
story.
We're always one step behind, aren't we?
Yeah. There's literally a whole load of options. You can have Exchange SP2, you can have BlackBerry, you can have GoodLink, all these different options for push email. But if you're running, I don't know, Hoola or Zimbra or Courier IMAP, then what do you do for push email?
I have a thickies question here.
Yep.
The BlackBerry Enterprise server, which is the thing which plugs into Exchange and then makes the push email happen, assuming you're not using this app today.
Yeah.
Does it only plug into Exchange?
Yeah.
Yep.
Definitely. It can't plug into an IMAP server. It can't plug into anything. Not Lotus Notes, not Netmail.
Nothing at all.
That's the point. I mean, it seems...
GoodLink will plug into Lotus Notes and Exchange.
Right, okay. So, I mean, people are looking to deliver third-party stuff on stuff other than Exchange.
Sure, but, I mean, they've got no choice because Microsoft have just introduced their own their own push email in SP2 for Exchange 2003.
It'll be a matter of time before Zimbra do it, I reckon.
You reckon?
I don't know much about push email. I've never used it before, but how complicated technically is it to do?
I'll tell you, right? There are two main complications. One is with systems like BlackBerry, they, for some reason, insist that all the traffic goes through their servers in Canada or wherever it is, right? So that complicates it to an extent. The second thing is security. So with GoodLink, when you put the good mobile messaging software on your device, it takes over everything about your device. So if you want to take it off, you literally have to do a hard reset and lose everything.
Whoa.
Right, so what it does, it takes over everything so that when someone comes along and tries to hack into it, they can't then get into your Exchange server through some route through your mobile device or whatever. And they can't get out your
data. Their policy decisions, aren't they? Like the fact that it's got to go through Canada and the BlackBerry case and the security thing. Is there any proprietary or technical limitations, reason why we can't do it?
No, not at all. I'll explain how Exchange SP2 works, which makes it a lot easier. It has a direct connection between the mobile device and the Exchange server. And what happens is the mobile device makes an HTTP request to the Exchange server and has a response time of 15 minutes on it. So it'll keep it open for 15 minutes.
What?
And then 15 minutes later, it'll send another HTTP request. If you get an email within that 15 minutes, it
that's
returns.
That's not push.
I think it's...
No, of course it's not, but it is like
that's
push.
Pull.
No, yeah, but...
That's it opening up a connection to the thing. The connection's initiated from the mobile device.
Yeah, but that
fucking
means...
pull email. But that's just like having a thing which checks your mail every
semantics.
Minute.
But that means...
fucking called push email.
Hang on a sec. The reason that BlackBerry has to go through the BlackBerry servers and Good has to go through the Good servers is because otherwise, for some reason, it wouldn't know where the device is and it wouldn't know where to push the stuff to. Whereas, from what I understand, it's a lot easier for the device to actually do pull email, but make it behave as though it's pushed, so that the customer isn't going send and receive all the time. Because
you think it's a technically more feasible.
The server is in one place, and you always know what the IP address is of that, and you always know where to ping or whatever. Whereas with things like Good and BlackBerry, they are literal push, so they have to do weird things. And with BlackBerry, you have to have a relationship with the network operator, and the network operator has to have its own BlackBerry servers in their data center, which makes it even more complicated. So that is true push, whereas Exchange, you've got RAND, all that crap. So yeah, I mean, there's no reason why...
So hang on, are you talking about having open source push stuff on the server, or are you you get an open source BlackBerry Enterprise server or open source Exchange like Zimbra doing it, but talking to the Windows mobile device in your pocket
or whatever device. I mean, basically, what I'm saying is
presumably there's no reason why you couldn't have a Linux device like my Archos, for example, or the green phone, the Qtopia green phone, any old stock phone.
Yep.
Just make that kind of connection to a Zimbra server, which provided push email.
It'd be pretty expensive to do that, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, whereas the Exchange is apparently quite light on WAP charges or GPRS charges. I don't know how it works beyond what I've told you, but apparently it is fairly efficient. Now, to my mind, whatever the technical ways around it, it just feels like it's yet another way that when a company comes to say, right, we're not going to upgrade to the latest Exchange, we want to look at other alternatives, that everyone will go, but push email's really important to our business.
But
what are we going to do without it?
Sorry, I might be getting this wrong, but isn't push email something that's offered by your ISP, your phone provider or something like that?
No, precisely not.
No,
right.
I mean, with BlackBerry, they have to be involved. But right. Yes, as a consumer, you can buy it from Vodafone or whatever.
Well, I was going to say, how do they get sent to your phone? Are they
get pushed?
Yeah, but how do they actually get there?
GPRS.
Okay, so it's not like I wasn't sure whether it was like a feature on the wireless network.
No. It doesn't download over the ordinary phone thing. It basically sets up an internet connection.
Because I was going to say, I could understand why nothing is this, because it's a very restricted market. But anybody can set it up, and anybody can.
It's not using some weirdo proprietary concept.
It's
or
using
whatever.
HTTP is all it's using. Well, SP2 is.
Do you think part of it is because it's? I mean, like, it's so young, the technology, that not many people are actually using it.
Loads of people
are using it in very certain specific situations. No. But I'm guessing most SMEs aren't using it.
Bloody Lindsay Lohan uses BlackBerry.
Yeah, and like I say, I'm sure that celebrities, and I'm sure that big enterprise companies using it.
Yeah, but Fastly isn't a big enterprise company, and all the management have got
Mills and Reeve aren't a big enterprise company. We've got 500 employees. We're not IBM.
You're talking about SMEs, basically, well, of 100 people or something.
It just uncouples you from your desk.
What it means is...
Ah, shill the pushy man. Are you taking a job with BlackBerry by any chance?
I just haven't seen that many people using it.
Yeah, but we work in a rather
different kind of environment.
Well, like conferences anyway. And stuff like that, I mean.
But you're going to the wrong sort of conference.
Exactly.
You're okay, not I should go to the push email conference then.
No,
if you go to a business conference, a professional services conference, everybody's got a BlackBerry. Everybody.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so I haven't seen anybody using Linux at these conferences. It means nobody uses Linux and it's not very important.
Sure, I just
it's a very similar kind of thing. Push email is very popular in certain segments. Things like professional services areas, sort of thing aid does. People wear suits all day. Linux is very popular in different areas, you know.
By the way, the only person sitting in this room wearing a suit is
me.
You.
I just said professional services conference, the sort of thing I go to with my suit on.
While we're on email, and I'm asking this honestly and not with any hidden agenda, what happened to Hoola?
Don't know.
I think
Zimmer beat into the post.
I think they're still working. I don't think they've given up or anything.
Are they trying to get laid still?
I think they had a big splash and the splash dropped down and... and there's been
it just
no...
just never happened, did it?
What? My reference being to the Jeremy Zawodny thing.
I think they're still working on it. I think they peaked a bit early. There was the big splash, like Hoola, and then, I don't know, is it Dave Camp?
It's all about marketing, wasn't it?
I mean, he could well have been sitting there going, just shut up, pimping the Hoola. We're quite a distance away from actually being ready yet, people. Stop shilling it.
Your favourite word for tonight, isn't it?
It's a shame. I don't know why.
perhaps it's a shoo-in.
As we all know, a few weeks ago we had two fairly big releases come out. Fedora Core 6.
Speak for yourself, mate.
And Edgy.
No, I didn't know about Edgy. Did Fedora happen?
Actually, talking about Edgy, Fedora, just to hijack it a bit. I went on there and to the release notes and nothing seems to have changed much on the server side of things.
There are changes, yeah.
Because I was trying
to
find out.
But not a great deal, and this is my point. My point is not even six monthly updates. Updates in general. Why?
New releases, you mean?
New releases, yeah. Why? Why? So
sure, because I want a new version of Firefox.
Yeah, but you get a new version of Firefox every now and again anyway. So why does somebody have to draw a line somewhere and then stop it updating?
So I think
why can't my desktop just keep updating?
So why can't I just have Firefox 2 when it comes out rather than have to wait for some new version? I kind of get the point he's making.
The kernel changes regularly throughout throughout Dapper. The kernel will change.
Yep.
Firefox can change.
Yep.
Why can't it just keep changing?
Yeah, but the problem is that when, for example, take...
and then just do a big release when you've got something big to do, like going from 2.2 to 2.4 kernel.
So what you're saying is still do releases, but make them less
often. But when you've actually got something big to do, different, other than just updating a few packages, which you could have just updated anyway.
But your point is not that we do the big releases we've got now less often and you get nothing in between. You just let stuff trickle out all the time as it happens.
I don't see why we have to stop something.
Are you proposing that both Ubuntu and Fedora stop doing this and GNOME stop doing it? Because if you're going to say we want Ubuntu and Fedora to stop doing releases, they're still going to get everything in a big lump anyway, where GNOME do their 6-monthly release.
GNOME's a component of the operating system, isn't it? So that's fine. So you can just keep trickling updates through.
So basically Linux distribution.
Every time a new GNOME comes out, you just get it. You don't need the whole distro wrapped
aren't
around
these
it.
Things, though, all interdependent?
Sometimes I guess they are, but...
I don't know. I mean, I think it depends on your view. I mean, one reason, I suppose, for releases is that it's a snapshot of that distro at that time, and then after that, people can issue security updates. I think if you're constantly releasing software out there, unless it's a really strong security policy, there's a possibility that the software will be more vulnerable to security problems because there's more and more... You're essentially not patching bugs. Because you're always feeding features in, so you've never got a single point of contact to fix security issues.
Of course you have.
That's one issue. I don't think you do.
You release the security patches at the same time as you release the software patches.
Yeah, but the thing is that you'd release you couldn't patch specific security bugs because your feature target's always moving.
Well, no, you patch.
But the security patches come from upstream anyway. What the Debian, for example, is backport the security patches.
Not always. A lot of distros patch security problems.
But there's no reason why the distros can't patch the security problem instead of upstream. You don't have to just say, let upstream releases trickle in as they happen. There's no reason why you couldn't have an Ubuntu extra release of Firefox, even where there hasn't been an upstream release of Firefox with security patches in.
Yeah. It just seems a lot of hype and a lot of unnecessary...
I think unnecessary distribution releases are a bit pointless. I mean,
they are.
It frustrates me as a Linux desktop user that if I wanted to upgrade to OpenOffice 3, if it came out tomorrow, for example, I'd have to now wait 6 months unless I use some dodgy backport. That sort of thing. Yeah. When it's not part of the core operating system, like GNOME or whatever, then that sort of pits me off a bit.
Prime example, Fedora Core 6 didn't ship with Firefox 2 because it came out before. So yeah. Now what do I do? Do I wait for Firefox? Do I wait for Fedora Core 7?
Yeah. Or do you run a backport?
What you do is you install it from development. You just enable development. But that's not the point. I mean, the point is, if I'm going with a normal model of things, I now have to wait for Fedora Core 7.
Yeah.
So your idea basically is that everyone tracks development?
No, it's just... It's why. No,
but in the world you're proposing, wouldn't that just be like everyone tracking development? What would the difference be?
Yeah, there you go.
You're basically saying...
Right, so Debian Unstable or Fedora Development is what you're talking about.
Not necessarily, because is it not more about end-user applications that you're talking about, rather than core components. So you would be happy with
GNOME when Firefox goes from 1.5 to 2.
Yeah, you're talking about upstream releases.
I just
releases.
Get it.
I don't have to wait for a distro release
or anything like that. Yeah, just get it.
You're basically saying that the distros would track upstream releases, and then when they're available...
What the fancy malarkey wording is.
Well...
But I just mean when Firefox 2 comes out.
All right,
let me get it.
Let me put it in your language, okay?
Yes,
right.
Please.
So
what the fuck does tracking upstream releases mean?
Upstream
to anyone normal.
All right. Okay.
Leveraging.
Upstream.
This is your fucking job, explaining stuff like people don't understand it.
So
by
you just
the way.
Track so upstream do well releases. What the fuck does that mean?
Well, listen. Right. Upstream is the original. Developers of the software. So, for example, Firefox, the people who make Firefox, they're upstream.
Okay.
The Mozilla Corporation, upstream.
Right. So they make Firefox, they make a release.
Yes.
And then the distros will merge that into the release. So they're downstream. Okay.
Right.
Now, what happens, of course, is you've got this relationship in the fact that some people will take Firefox as an example. They'll put it in the distro, and then there might be a bug in that particular version, but it might be easy for the distro team to fix the bug in the Firefox that's in the distro and then send the patch for that fix back upstream.
Yeah.
Right? Or the patch may come from upstream and go downstream. That's the difference.
Okay, yeah.
Right? So what I'm saying is, my impression of what you're saying is that right now, we basically say a distro is going to have this 6 month, let's say, release cycle.
No fucking 6 month release cycle.
Hang on. Let me finish. That what I'm saying is that right now the distros say we've got a 6 month release cycle.
Yeah.
Okay. And we're basically trying to squeeze as much in that 6 month release cycle. Whereas you're saying we shouldn't have a release cycle. Whenever a new release comes out upstream, so like when Firefox 2 comes out, then that's packaged and ready for that particular distro.
That's basically
Debian.
There is a semi-important point there,
right.
Which is that you don't just take the upstream release and then make it available to your... If you're a distro, you don't just say, here's the upstream Firefox, here it is for you guys.
You add some value.
You do add some value. You integrate it into your distribution. So there's going to be a delay there anyway.
Well, that's fine. I'm happy to wait for that.
Right, but you're happy to wait for the delay, but you're not happy to wait for it to show up in a new release of the distribution.
Why does it have to come as this big new...
What you're talking about is Debian Unstable.
That's exactly what Debian Unstable is.
And what they do is every
Ubuntu
now and again they'll
based
go...
based on Debian Unstable?
Sort of, and sort of not. They'll pull in Debian Unstable at the beginning of an Ubuntu release.
So you take
release.
Debian Unstable and then put 6 month release cycles in.
The reason why they do that is because, in general, people like release cycles. They know that a piece of software is coming out at a certain time.
Enterprises might.
Well, I'd say home users as well, in some way.
If you look at something like Dapper, say, Dapper's got long-term support.
Yeah.
So there's a point where you can say, okay, I'm going to hang my hat on this, and we'll backport point patches to and new
will
versions
Dapper
of stuff
ever have Firefox
to that
2?
Point. No.
Unless you enable... backport.
Unless you're back. Unless it's a backport.
That is silly, in my opinion.
But people want that because they don't want it to change very much.
I wanted my operating system on my laptop, which was Dapper, to have Firefox 2.
The trouble is, I
don't see why I have to do a dist upgrade.
We need to make a distinction then between what the operating system is and the application software that sits on the operating system. And this is one of the things that's always kind of frustrated me slightly about being the user of an operating system that has centralized repositories for software, is that really you just have to wait until really, for any bit of software, it's all kind of counted as part of the operating system. You have to wait until the next release, which is what Aid's saying. So can we not have a distinction between the operating system
I'm happy for
fundamentals?
A new distro when something big like Upstart comes, and that's fundamental down at the operating system level, and I don't see how else you could
agree
do
with
it.
Yeah.
That would be good. I understand.
The thing is, this is particularly for ACK.
To 2.6 kernel. I understand that.
Just a comment for ACK, because did you guys use Debian?
Yeah.
Debian and Stable. Yeah. So it applies to you as well. With Debian and Stable, I mean, one of the things I liked when I first started using Debian, and ACK turned me onto Debian, was literally something would be released, someone will package it for Debian and Stable, and then you'd basically get it.
Yeah.
And that was brilliant. And yes, you don't have that with Ubuntu, you don't have that with Fedora right now, and yes, it does suck.
You see, the problem here is when you say Upstart or something fundamental to the operating system, that should be, you should wait for that, and that should be a new release. But Firefox, I want that straight away. But increasingly, things like Firefox will become a critical part of the operating system. If you look at Yelp, for instance, the GNOME help browser, that's Gecko inside it,
right?
The Firefox engine. So are you suggesting that you get a new version of Firefox, but you don't get a new version of the GNOME help browser, and then they have two different versions of Gecko on your machine? Or are you saying when you upgrade Firefox, you then upgrade the GNOME help browser as well, at which point you have got a whole new version of GNOME you need to pull in? Or what? Firefox doesn't look like a critical part of the operating system, but increasingly it is. Look at Internet Explorer on Windows.
Yeah.
It's massively critical to loads of applications which embed IE. And Firefox is becoming like, Conqueror on KDE.
OpenOffice then.
Is a point again.
Yeah,
OpenOffice isn't integrated like that.
Okay, but not now. So if I said to you, here's a new system, you'll get OpenOffice release when they happen, but you won't get Firefox. You go, that's fucking stupid.
Well, I wouldn't, because
I'd have to explain what Gecko is for you to get the point. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff which doesn't look fundamental, but is.
The thing is here, what we really want is, I'd say, like, with you, Aid, you've probably got, if you install, let's say, Edgy, you probably use stock for 95% of what's in there, but there'll be certain applications that you do want.
Oh, I don't know. I use a lot of stuff out of Universe.
And so out of Edgy, you've changed, you know, you've got an upgraded libc and you've got an upgraded libOil and you're using all that kind of stuff. No. You've probably got maybe
I had a Homer Simpson's dog moment then.
But the point is
Charlie Brown's teacher.
Yeah. Most of the distro,
I don't know what libOil does.
Most of the distro, you'll use stock stuff in there. You won't change it. I'm pretty sure that you've only changed a few things. Maybe Firefox, maybe OpenOffice, maybe Rhythmbox, you know, whatever. It doesn't really matter. But the point is that it should be easier to make those things happen in existing distros.
He's not, Jono's not talking about you using stuff in Universe instead of in main. He's talking about you using a more recent version of a piece of software than is in main.
Oh, okay.
So, for example, take Fedora. You want Firefox 2.
Yeah.
That in Fedora, probably 95% of the stuff that's shipped with Fedora, you'd be happy keeping those versions because you don't really care about it.
Absolutely.
But you want Firefox specifically. But that's not a problem with a distro.
To be honest with you, that's what backports are for.
Yeah, and that's
backport repository.
Backport should be better integrated into development distros.
Repository, so you just get it from there.
Yeah, development in Fedora has a lot of Ubuntu backports.
Right. The problem is that backports are generally treated by most people, I think, as a bit of a crusty hack.
Dirty, but
and I bet development's the same. If development breaks, do you get to just keep both pieces?
I don't know, I guess.
That's what happens with the backport stuff. You run the backports and then it breaks, they'll go, oh, that's terrible. Well, might look at fixing that tomorrow. But it's not, oh my God, this is a massive tragedy. Whereas if Firefox breaks in the released version, it's a problem. If it breaks in backports, then, you know, you were warned. We'll try and fix it, but best effort basis.
But that's the big problem with distro design, isn't it? It's the regressions.
They're bringing out a distro upgrade to a calendar sort of date, rather than some new feature that's just happened.
Now, I agree with you here, because I think that, although one of the nice things about 6-monthly cycles is that they're predictable, the one downside
is that
if fuck all happens, then...
And what if it happens in the 7th month?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, then you do what we did with what Ubuntu did with Dapper, and you delay it.
Right.
Yeah. And the thing is, I think there is a certain argument there for saying, wait until cool shit happens, and then ship it. Because for a lot of people will have upgraded to Edgy and have thought, well, it ain't really that
fucking
much
hell, my
different.
My computer's here. Broke. Oh, no, sorry.
That's only if they're using back ports or automatic.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying in theory, but speaking here with my...
Is that the official word, by the way?
Speaking here with my software manager's hat on from work, we've gone to timed releases for a lot of our internal stuff instead of feature releases. And the reason is that if you go with timed releases, you can say to people, we're not going to release yet. We're going to release in 6 months.
Yeah.
But if you go with feature releases, as 5 minutes after the last release, everyone's going, do another release. You want another release. You want this bit of software. Do it now.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've got no reason to say no then, because they go, well, it's a feature. It's important enough for a release. Do a release. You spend all your time doing releases and not actually writing any fucking
code. You just want a reason to say no.
Basically, yes.
None of them. No emails at all.
No, what happened there? Should we let them in on the secret?
Nobody sent us any interesting emails.
not since last night.
Yeah, we've recorded 2 shows in a row.
Damn it.
That's why we're so tired.
Yeah. It's hard work, isn't it, doing 2 shows?
It is.
Do you remember when we did 2 shows in a night?
That was a stupid idea.
That was a stupid idea because we were paralytically tired by the end of the second show.
We did it, though.
We were men.
We did. We are men. Hurrah.
That's a good show.
Yeah, I think we got some interesting discussion in there.
Yep.
So, no emails. So, what should we talk about?
Well, we have been talking amongst ourselves about Lug Radio Live 2007.
Yeah. 2007.
UK. We haven't really firmed any details up, but we are talking. It's obviously going to happen.
Yep.
That's all we need to know.
We don't know specifically where it's going to happen or when it's going to happen, but we hope to announce
it
fairly
soon. We know it's going to happen in the UK.
Yep.
And almost certainly in Wolverhampton.
Yeah.
And almost certainly in the summer. But send us your ideas at lugradio.org.
We'd be interested in your thoughts on when you think it should be. Should it be April, June, July, August,
and why?
September?
As well.
Yeah, and tell us why. On a postcard.
And importantly,
to John O'Bacon at Lug Radio Towers.
Shirtlugradio.org.
That works as well.
Last year when we did it, I think it was more of a success partly because we had a crew and they were really good. And they were in the yellow t-shirts and they did a really good job. So this year, next year, we want to have more crew. We want to have more people helping out.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the AV, like, I think it's safe to say the AV this year, well, the audio, the mics and shits, were pretty crap. Because there wasn't really... I didn't have enough time to kind of spend a lot of time in it, and we were rushing around trying to sort stuff out. So it'd be nice to have people helping out with things like that.
Tony was... to be fair to Tony. And they did all work very hard, but they were working under pretty trying circumstances.
Yeah, and we want to better organise that, so we need your help.
Yeah, so if we could organise something on the wiki, guys, start getting...
You do.
Absolutely. Like the buff points we were talking about earlier, like buff points, people love the buffs at Lug Radio.
We were talking about Lug Radio already.
I know. People love the buffs, and we're going to... But one complaint was that they were...
Can't hear a fucking thing!
Can't hear a thing because of the main talks.
Because Nick Butler was talking too loud somewhere else.
I'm a very loud man!
Is he like Loud Howard?
Have you not seen that?
No.
Dilbert.
He does this.
Oh, yeah. I've just started reading Dilbert.
Really? It's worth looking
at. I always
Scott Adams has just started being able to talk again after not being able to talk for a while.
Not very loud Scott. Probably a bad joke that was.
Let's get him on, see how it opens us.
But yes, let us know where you think, when you think Lug Radio Live should be. Stop doing impressions of Loud Howard. Or not so loud Scott Adams.
Anyway, so
fucking quiet Scott.
Anyway, so yeah, what you said about Lug Radio Live, that's good. Yeah.
Let's do that, whatever you said. Yeah. What did you say?
Absolutely.
Send us in your suggestions for
We've also got another idea that
send us an email to we should do whatever ACK thinks at lugradio.org. That'd be great.
We've got another idea that we'll probably let you.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Well, sorry about you were saying.
There's another idea that we've got that we're germinating at the moment
that
we'll let you know
idea.
About yeah. another time.
Ooh. That is. Yeah.
If you've got any ideas for that, then sure, look ready.
Someone's going to email and saying, "Yeah, you know that idea? I think it should be blue."
Yeah. Yeah. It should be an intelligent shade of heliotrope.
Can you guess what our secret idea is?
Yep.
Send us an
there'll
email.
Be an award.
Not
if
you.
You.
Yeah. So.
Well, thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks very much. A's got to get on a plane, so it's been a bit muddy, so good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Night.
No. Yeah. Meh. Ah, ah, ah.